Welcome to Season 2 of The Great Humbling. My name's Dugald Hine. I'm a writer and co-founder of a school called Home. Through the strange spring of 2020, I kept a weekly appointment with the futurist Ed Gillespie, where we would puzzle our way through the stories taking shape around the pandemic and how all this fits into a longer arc of social, political, and ecological crisis. We called these conversations The Great Humbling because we started from a sense that this is a time of being humbled, brought down to earth. And we wanted to ask what happens if we approach the moment we're in on those terms. Now we're back for a second season, where each week we'll be taking a state of mind that seems to be part of the mix of being alive just now. So this is The Great Humbling Season 2, Altered States. States of being, states of consciousness, and of course, the literal alteration of our nation states. Thanks for listening.
So, welcome to episode 3. We have covered a state of alert, a state of grace, and now we are covering a state of panic.
Panic? Did somebody say panic?
Yeah, I did.
You feeling panicked this morning, Ed?
No, not too much. I have to say, it's interesting when you're kind of exploring a state of panic when you're actually feeling relatively relaxed of a Tuesday morning.
Well, I tell you what then, before we get ourselves all worked up, why don't we revert to our traditional practice and start with whatever we've been reading or watching or listening to this week. What's been making you think this week, Ed?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I did actually have one of our listeners complain to me that they missed the format of us wandering through our reading and watching and listening of the previous week. So it's good to be back on this. And like many people, it seems I have also watched My Octopus Teacher, a little film on Netflix, which has been widely talked about and widely recommended by all sorts of diverse people. And it's about a South African guy called Craig Foster, who actually spent a year with an octopus, although the film itself was about 10 years in the making. And he goes on this incredible exploration of cold water free diving in a South African kelp forest, and builds this quite beautiful, trusting relationship with an octopus. And the octopus only lives for about a year, so it's a fairly intense thing. He describes their strategy as live fast, die young. But it's this amazing encounter with an ephemeral, intuitive intelligence. And one of the best cinematic examples, I think, of a sort of biophilic relationship that I've seen. And as a former marine biologist, I've been long obsessed with the cephalopods, and having read Other Minds, The Octopus and the Evolution of Intelligent Life by Peter Godfrey Smith, and The Soul of an Octopus by Cy Montgomery, which are both incredible books if people are touched by My Octopus Teacher. But it just describes this sort of intimate portrait of these extraordinary invertebrates. And the film was just stunning, meditative, and a really beautiful story of how a deep connection in the wild can change your life.
So last week we were talking about synchronicity, Ed, and I have to say I'm a bit curious whether you've experienced or noticed more synchronicity in your life as a consequence of that, or whether it's just me.
I seem to be on a bit of a roll on synchronicity, but I guess that's the very nature of the beast. But my friend Tristram Stewart of Feedback posted a beautiful picture from his Sussex farm of a double rainbow on the horizon, which sort of was perfectly framed by the landscape. And I jokingly commented, yeah, because he said, I can see the pot of gold. And I said, who would have thought that the pot of gold might be a compost heap? At which point, Tristan came straight back and said, it's really weird that you write that, Ed, because the foot of the outer rainbow on the right literally lands bang on the compost heap in the garden. And the foot of the inner rainbow lands on the veg patch that they planted in lots of compost and pig manure from the barn. So it was one of those moments. I made a flippant comment and it turned out to be exactly true.
And literally next to it in my feed was a photograph from Dan Knaus, who was part of the Homeward Bound series that we ran with a school called Home this spring, who is about 4,000 miles away from Tristram, and had also posted a photograph of a stunning double rainbow that he had seen same evening, different time zone.
Wow. The other thing I read, and this was, I was minded to mention this because of your excellent writing about the Swedish pandemic experience, which was a piece by Nick Cohen in The Observer on Sweden as the right wing sort of fantasy land. And it's a fairly typically spiky Nick Cohen piece, but it's saying, you know, right wing and the libertarians tend to laud Sweden's experience, but that doesn't actually validate their freedom. It invalidates our social responsibility in the UK, because he says, you know, the key point that they all miss is that Swedes are blessed with an extraordinary state support, which they pay for. And as he said, Sweden may not have been spared the storm, but it does have lessons for us on how to shelter society until the storm passes, whereas we have tended to be largely hanging people out to dry, which then reminded me of one of my favourite Swedish idioms, and you may know the original Swedish of this, that seemed appropriate on this state of panic episode to mention the Swedish expression, there is no cow on the ice, which is effectively the Swedish equivalent of don't panic.
Well, I have to tell you my favourite Swedish idiom, which is nu sker du I det blåa skåpet. Now you really shat in the blue cupboard. Which...
and what does that mean?
Well, half my Swedish friends have never actually encountered this, but I have had it validated for me by a few people as not just something that's made up to laugh at foreigners. I think the blue cupboard is sort of where you keep the fine stuff for when you have guests coming and you're going to lay the table for dinner. So it's basically the last place in the house where you should do a number two. So, but the thing that I come back to whenever I write about Sweden as someone who's lived here for 8 years now, I'm a Swedish citizen, but you know, coming from the UK originally, is the role this country plays in the political imaginations of people, both left and right, for millions of people who have never really been here. And I mean, I think probably Nick Cohen is guilty of a little bit of that himself in the article, but he's absolutely spot on about the paradoxes in the way that, you know, the right, who a couple of years ago would be all on how terrible things are in Sweden, are suddenly at the moment in one of their Sweden has the answer to everything, but let's not talk about taxation phases.
Yeah, so that's John Stewart on The Daily Show did a brilliant skit a few years back where he had a reporter go onto the streets of Stockholm, I think, and interview Swedes saying, you know, do you realize you're living in a socialist nightmare? with as you would expect, typically incredulous Swedish responses.
I can imagine. So, okay, things I've read this week. One just this morning, actually, a Medium post from Phoebe Tikal called Hall of Mirrors, which is, it's almost written as a short story. It's a very potent reflection on the language that circulates in the kind of change making and sustainability and social innovation and all of these spaces that I think you and I have both spent time around. There's a passage that I just have to quote to you, Ed. You think you will find a magic leverage point that will magically change everything. You sound like those who became sick, looking for the elixir of immortality. You are sick with how desperately you want to save the world. And it's not a bizarre response at all. You have every right to feel desperate to make this world better. The systems of oppression you are complicit in by being alive are hellish. But this desperation is also what is leading you to be trapped in dissociated loops of pseudo-change. And just Phoebe absolutely skewers the language that begins to detach from reality as it circulates amongst groups of like-minded and similar-looking people in certain kinds of spaces. And I guess the other person who I've been reading this week who I wanted to bring in is somebody who, for me, helps to bring things down and ground things whilst being committed to many of the same concerns and causes as the spaces that Phoebe is writing about there. And that's Alistair McIntosh. And I've been rereading this week Alistair's new book, Riders on the Storm, which is about climate change and the survival of being, as the subtitle puts it. Because I've been reviewing it for Dark Mountain's website together with Martin Shaw's Wolferland. Actually, my five-year-old thinks Riders on the Storm and Wolferland sound like they ought to be children's books.
They most definitely aren't children's books.
They're not, but they are very powerful, deep reflections, taking sort of different trajectories through the moment that we're in relation to climate change. And Alistair, for me, is somebody who's been incredibly important to me. First, as someone who I stumbled on his book Soil and Soul when I was 25 and I just sort of trashed my career at the BBC and was starting to figure out what the hell I was going to do with my life. And it rang clear like a bell, this book that was grounded in his experiences with the land reform movement in Scotland, the community buyout of the Isle of Eigg, the campaign that stopped the super quarry at Rhonyville in the Outer Hebrides, and then also the work in inner city Glasgow with the Golgale Trust there. Alistair, for me, is somebody who helps us not get lost in the spiraling language of social change, but hold it to what it means to be doing stuff for real and not burning out and not selling out. So it's great to have his voice again speaking to us in the middle of this phase of the climate crisis.
That's interesting that you mentioned Soil and Soul, because once we'd decided on Friday to do State of Panic as our next altered state, and I was just finishing up Nick Hayes's book, The Book of Trespass, which is obviously about a lot of land reform and property and access rights. And it was another moment of synchronicity, because he literally, you know, goes into exactly what I wanted and we wanted to talk about. And it's right at the end of the book, and he's contemplating a rather high-risk trespass to the Herne Oak in Windsor Park. And he's troubled by the potential recklessness of the security risks he might be running, slightly fearful about getting shot in order to trespass onto the Queen's estate. And he's describing waking up, having been wild camping just outside the park. And as the light is changing, he refers to it beautifully as what the Portuguese called madrugada, which is essentially the beginning of a process, which is the description of the dawn. And he has this sort of epiphany in his sort of strange sleep-deprived state of mind. He suddenly realizes, God, you know, I've felt this sense of overwhelming anxiety before, and I've also read about it. And then he refers back to perhaps the most lyrical and magical chapter of The Wind in the Willows, which is The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, which is often the chapter that gets omitted from adaptations of the book, even though in some ways it's actually the beating heart of it. And this obviously inspired Syd Barrett of Pink Floyd and the title of their first album. But basically, Ratty and Mole have come across Otter, who is panicking and searching for his lost child, and they offer to go out through the night to search for him. And eventually at dawn, they follow a soft piping music to find the baby otter curled up and sleeping beneath the strangest sight the pair of them have ever seen, which is Pan. And I'll just read this little excerpt because I think it's stirring stuff. And then in that utter cleanness of the imminent dawn, while nature, flushed with fullness of incredible colour, seemed to hold her breath for the event, Mole looked in the very eyes of the friend and helper, which is the unnamed Pan, saw the backward sweep of the curved horns gleaming in the growing daylight, saw the stern hooked nose between the kindly eyes that were looking down on them humorously, while the bearded mouth broke into a half smile at the corners, saw the rippling muscles on the arm that lay across the broad chest, the long supple hand still holding the panpipes only just fallen away from the parted lips, saw the splendid curves of the shaggy limbs disposed in majestic ease on the sward, saw, last of all, nestling between his very hooves, sleeping soundly in entire peace and contentment, the little round, podgy, childish form of the baby otter. All this he saw for one moment, breathless and intense, vivid on the morning sky, and still as he looked, he lived, and still as he lived, he wondered. Rat, Mole found breath to whisper, shaking, are you afraid? Afraid, murmured the rat, his eyes shining with unutterable love. Afraid of him? Oh, never, never, and yet, oh, Mole, I am afraid. Yeah, it's a stunning piece of writing from Kenneth Graham. And it just sort of played to that idea of pan and panic and the pandemic. And the pandemic itself, you know, the etymology of that comes from the Greek pan, all, and demos, people, of all the people.
Mm. Wow. Well, that is a children's book, although not your average one, is it? Do you know, as I was listening to you read that, I suddenly made a connection, because there's a wonderful video that Martin Shaw made a few years ago where he talks about prayer, and he says, you know, it's enough to address the friend. You don't have to know more than that about who might be on the other end of prayer, but prayer itself as a practice is a powerful thing. So now I'm wondering if the friend and helper from Wind in the Willows is somewhere in the mix of that idea of just praying to the friend. But just to get things clear, Ed, there's actually no connection etymologically between the pan in pandemic and the pan in panic, right? Because the first one, as you say, pan, demos, is all the people. And the second one is from the god Pan, but the god Pan comes from a different Proto-Indo-European root. I'm talking like I know loads about etymology now. I just looked this up and read a few articles about it. But it's more nice coincidence than strict philological accuracy that we weave these things together.
Let's just call it another synchronicity. But I mean, I think isn't that the point of Pan, that he is all, actually, the embodiment of the wild, which is all there is?
Well, I'll buy that. I tell you why I wanted to talk about the state of panic, though, and this does go back to Riders on the Storm and Wolf the Land, because the thing with those two books is I don't think either of them would have been written if it hadn't been for what happened around 2 years ago. You know, firstly, 2 years ago last month, when a girl in a yellow raincoat sat in the street outside the Swedish Parliament. And then 2 years ago next month, when a crowd gathered in Parliament Square in Westminster to declare a rebellion against the government of the UK. And this whole wave of activism and awareness and emotion around climate change that we've seen, that I think, you know, both of us as people whose work has been involved with climate change in one way or another for a long time have been aware of this as a kind of as a rupture. And not just a rupture that we observe at arm's length, but something that changes the context in which we talk and think and work. And for me, one of the most distinctive things about these new climate movements is the emotional palette, the states of mind and states of being that are invoked. And I think of that incident at the start of 2019 when Greta Thunberg was at Davos, sort of the beginning of the whole crazy thing of world leaders taking selfies with her that she's very scathing about. And it was Christine Lagarde of the IMF who tweeted a selfie and said something along the lines of, "I have hope about the future because of young people like Greta Thunberg." And the next day, Thunberg stood up in front of this Davos audience and said, "I don't want your hope. I don't want you to be hopeful. I want you to panic." And for me, it's one of the most striking statements of these movements, because if you think back to like 2005, 6, 7, the last big wave of attention around climate change, what you had was, you know, Al Gore's slick PowerPoint presentation of an inconvenient truth. And the experience of that is you're kind of walked up to a viewing post about a quarter of a mile from the edge of the abyss and shown what's at stake, and then walked safely back and given a list of things to do that will make it all okay. Whereas what I see in the key figures of the past 2 years, you know, whether it's Greta Thunberg or whether it's people around Extinction Rebellion or Deep Adaptation or whatever, is people who seem to be hanging out there over the edge with no promise that it could all be okay. And it's powerful. You know, I've seen a lot of people who've crossed a line in these past 2 years, people who hadn't really paid that much attention before and who've gone, I think of it as the line from, oh yeah, climate change, to, oh, fuck, climate change. You know what I mean? I mean, can you remember when you first crossed that line, Ed?
Oh, yeah, vividly. I mean, I think my trip to Antarctica at the start of 2016 was a turning point for obvious reasons. I was there in the summer, but it wasn't even really that cold. And speaking to the polar veterans on the ship, that was a moment of, you know, distinct unease. And I think that sense of discomfort then slowly metastasized in the coming months, coupled with several difficult conversations with my old friend Jem Bendel. And this was before his deep adaptation paper in July 2018. And even then, I was, guess ironically, still in some form of my own denial. It's hard to let go of something when you've been so dedicated to it for so long. And as I say, I spent almost 20 years of my adult life working as a sort of climate activist and communications consultant around sustainability. But I mean, for me, it was the IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees, which was published on the 8th of October in 2018. That's when I think it all went critical for me. Because when I read it, it dropped like a dirty bomb. And I knew then it wasn't a game changer. It was in many ways the end of the game as I had been playing it for almost 20 years. And that floored me. That really humbled me. And it brings to mind another piece I read this week by a Sri Lankan guy, Indy Samarajiva, which is talking about the situation in America and what it feels like to go through a societal collapse. And he describes the sort of mundanity of the day to day while things are going on around you, which in some senses are horrific and horrendous. And he says, if you're trying to carry on while people around you die, your society is not collapsing. It's already fallen down. Collapse is just a series of ordinary days in between extraordinary bullshit, most of it happening to someone else. And that's all it is. And I think that's a really stark reminder from, there's a lot of articles like this doing the rounds at the moment from people offering the warnings from their own sort of quite hard won personal experience. But I think your epiphany was rather earlier than mine, Dougald, prescient fellow that you are.
Well, I've been trying to piece together how it was for me, whether there really was that oh fuck moment, whether it was maybe a series of smaller moments that came together. You know, I've got this very distinct memory that I've spoken about of, you know, clambering up on desks in the BBC newsroom where I was working, and this would be 2005, to switch off all of the monitors that everyone had left on. And that kind of OCD switching off of light switches and recycling. I didn't have a car, I still don't. And there weren't door-to-door recycling services in those days. So I remember walking down this street in Sheffield, carrying these bags of several weeks' worth of newspapers and other recycling, and one of the bags splits. I'm just standing there in the middle of the street swearing. And I guess for me, those are sort of snapshots from this first phase of panic, which is also a kind of bargaining. Like, there's a logic going on there. And I've seen lots of people go through this where, you know, climate change gets real to you. And then you go into this panicked mode as if you can make a deal with the universe where, if I just do enough of the good things to do that are on Al Gore's to-do list, then it's all going to be okay. Actually, I have to tell you this one. I was kicked out of Al Gore's climate talk. This must have been around 2007, and it's less dramatic than it sounds. Actually, he had this policy where media were banned from his talks, presumably sort of PTSD from his experience of his presidential run in the year 2000. And I was there as a journalist. And so we got to sit through all of the preamble speeches by everybody who wanted to be on the same bill as Al Gore, and then the little stand-up routine that he starts the presentation with, and then his press handlers were like, right, now you're out. And I had a bit of an argument with him. But what I remember is one of the people who was on the kind of warm-up bill was some junior government minister from the New Labour government who was standing on the stage, and she said something along the lines of, we can do it because we have to do it. Like, we can make our society sustainable because we have to. And this was meant to be this kind of powerful piece of, you know, Obama-like rhetoric. And I just sat there, I went, that logic doesn't work. And I began to realize that I was hearing versions of that kind of rhetoric all over the place. And maybe that contributed to crossing this sort of second threshold where you have to let go of the bargaining and release your grip on the future and maybe recognize that it never was all okay. It was never going to be all okay. I said something about this last week with Dark Mountain, that my sense is that out of our own need, and I'm talking about me and Paul at the beginning, out of our own need for a place where you can land when you release that grip on the future, we created something which offered other people a place to land. And that's a lot of what Dark Mountain was and what it meant to me and to other people who were drawn into it in the years when I was at the heart of it. But it was small. It was countercultural. It was, you know, 300 people gathering for a weekend in some fields. It wasn't anything like the scale of what we've seen over the last couple of years. And I feel very grateful at times not to have been under the level of scrutiny and the level of media attention that the people at the heart of these new movements have been under. But I do wonder, are people finding that place to land? Because sometimes it seems more like I see people stuck in a loop of panic, you know, sharing endless doom-laden links on Facebook, these little salami slices of the apocalypse.
Shrill is the word I often use. I mean, it's often as if the attitude is it's just one more piece of compelling evidence will be the straw that breaks the climate resistance camel's back. But the camel's been broken on the ground for some time and there's a haystack on its hump. Yeah, I think it's just that there's that one more push mentality. And I hear what you're saying about these sort of loops of panic, because, you know, if you look at actually the definition of panic, it is that sudden sensation of fear, which is so strong as to dominate or prevent reason and logical thinking. And it replaces those with overwhelming feelings of anxiety and frantic agitation, consistent with what we've discussed in State of Alert as an animalistic fight or flight reaction. And I think the challenge now is panic is not just occurring singularly in individuals, but actually suddenly in large groups as sort of mass panic related to herd behaviours. And the psychologists Leonard J. Schmidt and Brooke Warner describe panic as that terrible, profound emotion that stretched us beyond our ability to imagine an experience more horrible. And then they add that physicians like to compare painful clinical conditions on some imagined Richter scale of vicious, mean hurt. And to the psychiatrist, there's no more vicious, mean hurt than an exploding and personally disintegrating panic attack. So I think there is a concern that panic is infectious. You know, that you can lead to this sort of mass hysteria, mass psychosis, mass panic and social contagion. And, you know, does it feel like a sense of mass panic is what we need?
It's tricky, isn't it? Because if you look at our societies as a whole, I find it difficult to argue that we are too far across the line into alarm when it comes to climate change. I think, objectively speaking, we are still way in the territory of complacency as a whole, as societies. So I'm not sure that mass panic or mass hysteria is what we are seeing right now. But there is something about the urge to panic which closes down the options. Alistair McIntosh talks about this in Riders on the Storm. He says, you know, I'm resistant to contracting the possibilities of the future to this single narrative of human extinction or inevitable near-term societal collapse, or whichever, whosever certainty, whosever's framing it is. And I think back to what Tunbai was saying at Davos, and this binary between hope and panic. And I'm wondering about how else we face the future, because the kind of hope that she was denouncing there is a kind of hope that I want to see denounced, especially amongst the kind of people who gather at Davos. And where else do we go? And this makes me think of a project that I've been involved in that has come to a head a couple of weeks ago that's really exciting. It's now out in the world. It's a production by Riksteatern, Sweden's touring national theatre. It's called Kartan över oss, The Map of Us. And the concept is, it's in the form of an app, an audio walk, where you put your headphones on and you're guided around and you've got a map on your phone. But when you show up for the beginning of it, you're also greeted by the arrangers in their orange vests. And they are the local representatives of this new Swedish bureaucracy, the Authority for Emotional and Spiritual Preparedness, which has been tasked with mapping how Sweden feels about the future.
Does feel very Swedish.
It does, doesn't it? And over the next 3 years, this agency is going to be out there around the country. It's already in 40 different towns and villages and neighborhoods up and down Sweden. And as you put the headphones on, you have this calm, authoritative woman's voice guiding you through, giving you instructions, setting questions to you about the future, where you have to answer these massive questions like, you know, look around you. Do you feel that the place where you're standing will be a good place to live 100 years from now? And you answer it by choosing yes or no. And you choose by walking to one location or the other location on the map. You've got like a red dot for no and a green dot for yes. And so in this way, this audience that started out together branches out along different routes into different futures, having the story of that, the future that your choices are leading you into, told to you as you go. At the end of this first act, you find yourself pacing the years of your life along the street, one step for each year you've lived so far, and then one step for each year you expect that you have ahead of you. And for me, it happened that that part came as I was heading west into a lowering afternoon sun along this street in a neighborhood of Stockholm where I used to live years ago. And then at the end of that, you're prescribed a future reflection from one of the authority's specialists. It might be a psychologist or a tech expert or the Archbishop of Uppsala. Or if you chose a really pessimistic route into the future, then you might get my voice in your ear as you start to walk back to the start.
And what do you say to people who are really pessimistic about the future?
Well, firstly, I say, I've got one prediction for you. We're all going to die. And that was always the case. And then I talk about where we're all headed, because we're not really headed into the future. That's an illusion. Where each of us is headed is the past. And this lovely thing in Swedish, the word for the past is det förflutna, which means something like that which has floated away.
Mm.
And I have this image which echoes something Stephen Jenkinson says, which is, you know, we're all in our little boats, and for a little while we're kind of rowing along in one direction, but sooner or later the rowing stops and the river is going to carry us back off into the same direction as everyone before us. And there is a calmness that can come with grounding ourselves in the knowledge of our own mortality and in the depths of time. And I talk about the past as what anchors me on the days when the future feels too heavy to bear. And I tell stories from other times of endings, human stories, geological stories, stories from archaeology. And it's not that it offers any happy endings, but maybe it helps to open a space beyond the immediacy of panic, in which we can then let our eyes adjust to the dark, let our ears attune and begin to notice the kinds of possibility that remain that may not look like the shapes in which we were taught to look for possibility and hope by the societies that we grew up in.
I really love that definition of the Swedish past. It reminds me of a poem, actually, I wrote called On a Rising Tide. When you go with the flow, you go where the flow goes, usually downstream in a race to the bottom. From the wide perspective of a high hill, gravity's lure is a well-worn drawdown into familiar riverbeds of channeled thinking, hard-sided culverts and storm drains to contain even the most exuberant flashes of creative floods. But on a rising tide, you can drift upstream, against the natural current, slowly seeing the world as it is, beyond the vapid rapids, the delicious serenity to just sit and be. But I wanted to bring us back to a sort of poetic conclusion just by reading a passage which was posted on Facebook right at the start of the pandemic. And it's by a guy called Deja Hu, and I don't know if that's his real name. Perhaps it is. I have a strange sense I might have heard it before. And he's one of the founders of the Into the Wild Festival. And he wrote this right at the start of the shenanigans we've been experiencing back in March. And finally, the great ancient god of nature, of the wild places, of the mossy brooks and golden hills, of the damp forests and hidden glades, the protector of beasts, of horned and hoofed, of wild lichen eyebrows and musk deer pungent aromas, swells in through the ether, playing his deep evocative rhythm of enchantment on his bone flute. From beyond the veils, from under the other worlds, he curls his misty-eyed brow towards humanity once again, reminding them that their tiny, insignificant lives are mere dewdrops on the vast garden of existence. All their self-help seminars and self-important narcissistic endeavours are nothing but the froth of waves on the infinite sun rays of existence. You can wash your hands, but you cannot wash away the wild, the mysterious, the ravaging, wild, ferocious tenacity of the wild world. You can try and blame it on 5G or 4G or GG. You can create as many concepts as you like, but in the end, nature will roar with wild and ecstatic, bloodthirsty longing to take us all home to where we began. The deep, dark emptiness where everything arises and begins, time without end. Pan, the original horned god, once again steps out of the shadows with his name on the tongues of all beings. Pandemic. Pandemonium, panic, panacea, all bursting forth like wild flowers yearning to kiss the sky. In this realm, there is no good or bad, high or low, rich or poor, just a wild, abandoned expression of life and death, forever dancing in the orgasmic Milky Way of existence, radiant in its potential. For we are nature in our deepest dreaming, before we civilized ourselves into square boxes and ready meals. We are life and death. We are the earth-woven lovers of the wild. We are that radiant, mysterious emptiness. We are Pan. We are all people. Listen to the call of all beings, deep in the dark of night at the cusp of dawn or dusk, and you will hear your ancient voice forever singing you back home. Hush. It's quite an extraordinary piece of writing. And I think to finish, for me, the last thing is actually the sort of antidote to this is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy emblazoned on the cover was the words, "Don't panic," in very large and friendly letters. And the joke is that, you know, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy outsold the Encyclopedia Galactica, not only because it was slightly cheaper, but because it had those words, don't panic, emblazoned on the front. And even, you know, Elon Musk apparently emblazoned don't panic on the screen on the dashboard of the Tesla that he rather bonkersly fired into space a couple of years ago. And I just wonder, you know, going back to what you were saying about the role and the balance between hope and panic, whether don't panic is a sort of a rather flat instruction, because maybe the panicking snaps us out of the numbness. And I do, and have felt for some time, that if you're not feeling slightly panicky, then you're not paying attention. But for me, like all these altered states we're exploring, it's not about allowing a state of alert to overwhelm you into hypervigilance, a state of grace to elevate you into high-minded acquiescence, or a state of panic to drag you into, as Deja Hu says, pandemonium.
Oh, I guess it's about moving through rather than getting stuck. You know, lots of states can be appropriate to a particular moment. Panic, anger, despair, detachment are not so healthy if they become something fixed, an end point, a loop, game over, just who you are. So I want to loop back here to the start, because I mentioned Alistair McIntosh and Riders on the Storm. And partly because I think we need a space in which to move through some of these powerful visceral reactions to the existential encounter with climate change, I decided to host a month-long online series starting in November, where we'll be reading Alistair's book and also Martin Shaw's Wolf for Land and the long essay from Vanessa Andreotti and the Decolonial Futures Collective that I talked about a couple of weeks ago. And we'll have small reading groups, and we'll have live webinars when we're going to be joined by Vanessa and Martin and Alistair. So I guess this is a trailer, really. If that sounds like something you need this autumn, then it's on the School Called Home website, aschoolcalledhome.org. We'll put it in the show notes this week, because I think we need spaces where we can have these conversations. Not just listening to the two of us chatting each week like this, but also spaces in which to meet each other and be together to the extent that these technologies allow us to be together around all of this.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription. A provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with and needs a little time and space to breathe. If you are new to the podcast, please do revisit season one, as we are aiming to build on ideas, insights and narratives already touched upon. And together, this will hopefully enable us all to make a little more sense of these strange times we are living through. Please do comment, ask questions and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or via my Twitter account, @frucool. And we would obviously deeply appreciate and be grateful for any ratings, reviews, recommendations or sharing you might feel compelled to contribute as a result of listening. Our title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions, used gratefully under a Creative Commons license. We're living in a time of humbling, an initiation at a cultural scale. Please join us on this emergent journey.